Well, welcome to the film discussion of Alien Boy, Life and Death of James Chassie. We have here today the filmmaker of Brian Lindstrom, the newly elected Multnomah County District Attorney, Mike Schmidt, and my friend, the Reverend Dr. Leroy Haynes of the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Peace and Justice Reform and the Allen Temple CME Church. Ryan, let's talk to Mike first. Mike's going to have to scoot out in about 30 minutes, and then we'll talk to Dr. Haynes. Dr. Haynes, if you want to interject, please do. But Ryan, do you have some questions for Mike about the sure. film?
Well, first of all, I just, you know, have to, after seeing the film, just say, you know, our thoughts and prayers are with the Chassie family, and, you know, what a terrible loss. And James, you are remembered. DA-elect Mike Schmidt, can you please tell us, if this happened today, would you envision a different outcome?
Thanks, Brian. You know, watching the film, especially in the context of where we are right now, was challenging. And, you know, I have to think there would be a different outcome. I think people are more focused on this issue in this immediate moment than ever before. And we have all kinds of conversations going on about police accountability and reform. And I hope that a lot of the discussions that we have are going to actually focus on some of the things that I think we could have done a lot better when Mr. Chassie was killed. So I do have hope that things would be different today than what we saw in the film.
One of the things that struck me, and I think I can speak for Jason as well, when we made the film, was just the enormous power of the Portland Police Union. And I'm just curious, in the, what now, 6 years since the film was made, 7 years, has that power diminished at all? Is it still, what I really felt it was like the most powerful political entity in the city, if not the state. And I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, I mean, I think there's power in different ways. One of the powers of the police union is obviously the bargaining agreement and their ability to get terms in the bargaining agreement that make it difficult to hold police officers accountable, to discipline police officers, to how the investigations roll out. So there's that power. And I don't know that in the 6 years since this film that's diminished much. We're still talking about changes that should be made in the police contract, and the community has had an opportunity to weigh in with, you know, the elected officials and the city council. But it really remains to be seen how successful they can be in getting some accountability measures into that agreement. So there's that power. But then there's the political power of what they what that union says in terms of who candidates they're backing and positions that they take. And, you know, when I started running for district attorney, some of the advice that I got from people was, you know, hey, do whatever you can to at least neutralize the police union. Get them not to be against you. You know, don't take hard positions on things. And, you know, I didn't listen to that advice, and I said what I believed and talked about the things that I wanted to see happening if I was elected DA. And the police union weighed in on the campaign. They donated heavily to my opponent and in his favor. And I was elected with 77% of the vote. So, you know, maybe that's changed. Maybe the political power and the persuasion that they hold over the public opinion has waned since the time of this film.
Can I ask your thoughts on the defund the police movement?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think, I have a lot of thoughts in terms of, I want to keep listening to the conversation, engaging. I don't see an immediate path forward for having zero police in our community. I think there are certain things that we're always going to need police for. You know, I think about crimes, immediate violence, domestic violence, sexual assault. I mean, we need murders, obviously, we need officers. So I don't know that defund police means we don't have police, right? It means let's reassess what are the things that we are using police officers to do in our community. And I think that's a good conversation to have. Do we need officers to respond to all of the different calls that they are receiving today? Or can we, take those responsibilities and put them into a different place? You know, I think about Commissioner Hardesty's and Street Roots, Portland Street Response, right? I think that was an earlier, I mean, they didn't call it defund the police. But that was the thought process is, do we need police officers to respond to nonviolent mental health situations, or are there people that are better equipped to handle those types of calls? I think of police officers like Swiss Army knives. They kind of can handle a lot of situations, but just because they can handle it doesn't necessarily mean they're the best tool for the job always. And so I think defund the police is a critical conversation we should be having in our community in terms of thinking about what is the right tool for the job that we're facing. And we've heard from police officers for a long time that, society's defunding of our mental health institutions, of our not properly funding our addiction treatment, all of those problems, not properly funding educational systems, they're all falling into the net of law enforcement. And I've heard many police officers in Portland across the country saying, we're not the best tools to handle all of society's problems. And so to me, defund the police is calling for a critical reevaluation of where are police officers the right tool for the right job and where can we do something different?
Power being what it is, it's very unusual for an institution to want to voluntarily give up power or money or budget. Do you anticipate the union cooperating and being open to the defund the police movement? And let's just say from the outset, when we say defund the police, we don't mean there would be no budget for police. We just mean exactly as you said, that things like mental illness and addiction would be treated with more community-based organizations that have expertise in those areas.
I don't know. I haven't talked to Daryl Turner, the current president, or any of their union executive committee on this. So I'd just be speculating. But I think that they are at a moment where they have to consider, whether or not they want to be a part of this conversation and want to be a part of it, or if they're going to oppose and dig in against. Ultimately, they are a union, and unions have a vested interest in having members and growing membership. I think that's a hard, challenging question for unions to say, we want to voluntarily, bring down our numbers in the union. So I don't know where they're going to land at, but we're also at a moment where it's clear when you see how the community feels about policing our community. And then you look at Minneapolis, where they just decided that the city council at least has said that they will start from scratch again with their police department. So, I think that this is a time for very thoughtful consideration of our positions and seeing if, how can we listen to the community and our community leaders, especially our Black leaders in our community, who have been telling us for a long time that this isn't working or meeting their public safety needs. How can we really legitimately listen to their feedback and act on it? I think it's going to be a tough question for the union to see how they come out.
There's people on the outside of the district attorney's office might see that there's an inherent conflict of interest in the district attorney prosecuting police officers, since you work with them on an everyday basis. How do you go about resolving that conflict?
Yeah, Jason, I think that's exactly right. That's one of the things I identified in the campaign as an issue that we need to resolve. And my position was that we ought to bring in an independent agency to handle that prosecution. And in my opinion, the best independent agency to bring in the state of Oregon right now is the Oregon Department of Justice. I have seen other proposals for appointing a special prosecutor in those situations, mm-hmm. and or having a special, maybe even autonomous governmental entity that doesn't currently exist to handle those investigations. I think those could be good things to consider and talk about. But as we are currently constituted, I think the Oregon Department of Justice is best situated because, first of all, they have great attorneys who handle these cases, and they already pick up conflict cases when district attorneys, for some reason, have a conflict in prosecution. You know, for example, if a family member of mine was being prosecuted, we'd bring in probably either someone from DOJ or another district attorney's office. So they already have that expertise. They've already been doing it. And what I particularly like about the Oregon DOJ option is that they are not beholden to local police agencies. The attorney general is a statewide elected official. So it really removes a lot of those incentives and political considerations that I think even district attorneys in other jurisdictions would face if they were to come into Multnomah County and be that independent investigative agency. I don't know that that completely alleviates the underlying issue that police and prosecutors work together. And it's a good thing that police and prosecutors work together on a daily basis. They should be friendly. They should build friendships because most of the time they're on the same team. But when the prosecutor's office is called on to prosecute police officers, that creates a conflict. And I think it's only right, even when DAs are doing everything correctly and by the book and everything the way they should, the community's always gonna have a question about whether or not that bias or that, that friendship crept into the decision-making process. And the only way to alleviate that is to have outside independent investigation prosecution.
Yeah, credibility is really, has been damaged over the last couple of weeks. And it's hard to really tell how to repair that. The mayor has proposed 19 reform programs to begin that process. Most of it has to do with things we've been trying to do already for a while and haven't done very well at. The city has, I don't know, a dozen different committees and councils to advise them about police, and pretty ineffective. How do we begin to re-engender the credibility and trust necessary to do police work?
Yeah, I'm facing similar thoughts as I think about taking over the district attorney's office. And where my mind always goes is transparency first and foremost. How do we get the information what decisions you're making, how you're making those decisions, why you're making those decisions, what the outcomes were. I focused my thoughts and attention at the statewide level on this issue, where we have instituted statewide police profiling data systems so that we can capture every time a police officer makes a stop, their perception of the person's race and ethnicity. And then we can actually start to look and see how decisions are being made. So in the district attorney's office, that'll be my focus, is making my office as transparent as possible. I want to put our data up on a publicly available website or dashboard so you can see the cases being referred to us, what charges are ultimately made, and then how those cases are resolved. I'm more of a prosecutorial, that's my field of expertise. But I got to think there's corollaries into policing that we should be trying to make that as transparent as possible, how they make decisions, especially around discretionary arrests and charging decisions that are more up to the police officer's individual discretion, and tracking those things. And then I think one of the things that we've seen clearly in the George Floyd case is we need to know and have a robust way of tracking officer, complaints or use of force issues or disciplinary issues, not just in the immediate instant, but like across their entire career, so that we can start to be detecting patterns and practices and making sure that information is available and known. I mean, ultimately, police officers are public servants. District attorneys are public servants. I think the community has a right to understand a lot of that information, and hopefully that transparency can help rebuild some trust.
The Chassis story talks about one pathway of credibility damage of the police use of force, but you mentioned another, which is traffic stop data, that we see an unfortunate data there. Dr. Haynes, would you like to step in here? You know a lot about this.
Well, I think our new district attorney is moving in the right direction. I think I totally agree with him that we need a special prosecutor that comes out of the State Attorney General Office and the Oregon DOJ to be independent and to be able to investigate cases as well as prosecute cases. And so we're certainly on board and target with that. First of all, I want to thank you and also the director of the film. It has created over the years a consciousness within people of the issues that we are faced with the police enforcement of the law throughout this country. We often say in the Obama Ministry Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform that this struggle is a marathon and not a sprint. And that's what I try to educate younger people on, that it's not going to be over in 6 months. It's not going to be over in a year. Because you're going to have a backlash that takes place with the police union, and status quo forces are going to return and begin with their propaganda to try to turn the issue away to chaos, looting, and violence, rather than on the issue of having equal treatment within the police forces, in particular in our city, the Portland Police Force. I want to say that James Chassis was a key towards the small increment progress that has taken place within the Portland Police Bureau, because it was a key along with the Aaron Campbell case of bringing in the Department of Justice, the Federal Department of Justice, to do an audit of the Portland Police Bureau, where the findings came out that the excessive force and deadly force was used against persons that were mentally ill or perceived to be mentally ill. But there's a backdrop to all of this, in that since 2003 with the Kendra James case, that we started off where 5,000 persons marched for police reform, and that tragic and horrendous shooting of a Black female mother by Portland police officers, and the continuous shootings that have taken place, and African-American male and women, as well as those with mental illness and perceived with mental illness. There are some things that we have to do, and Mike mentioned quite a few of those things, but the foundation of everything has to center on accountability. If we do not have accountability in both the criminal prosecution as well as the professional, we have decided here in Portland that those two items can go along parallel. They don't have to. You don't have to wait till the criminal prosecution has been done. to have the parallel official administrative prosecution to take place and to decide whether that individual police officer used excessive force or deadly force. And so that through the DOJ and the federal DOJ, we have lifted up some issues, and there's been incremental progress, but nothing really substantive. Incremental progress and changing the policies and incremental progress and changing their training, incremental progress in the terms of those city entities like IPR and Citizen Review Board. But to tell the truth, these entities do not have power. And in order to have officers accountable, there needs to be power divvying. And so the MA Coalition has pushed for a citizen review board with subpoena power to be able to compel officers to testify. And it has to be citizen driven in order to take that. Also, we've requested that the state stature on the use of deadly force by law enforcement be narrowed, and that instead of being just reasonable, to make it a necessity for officers to be able to use deadly force or excessive force. And that, and I think we have those entities going on, but what the recent case of George Floyd has shown us, that we have officers that care for the community and want to really do community policing, but we also have officers that oppose anyone holding them accountable. And until we can have some accountability, this issue of excessive and deadly force will continue to go on even after the marches have stopped, because one day they will slow down. I've been in the movement, the freedom movement for justice and equality. I marched with King since I was 13 years old, and I know that there's a push and there's a counter push, you know, and we are doing the push right now, but there's going to be a counter reactionary by those status quo forces to keep things in check and to continue to support officers that use excessive force and deadly force. And so that's a reality, and any strategy that we have in the movement that's taking place now. And I see the passion out there. I see the mass participation. Anytime you can draw 10,000 people each night, you see that the atmosphere has changed. And we have changed the atmosphere before in the 48-hour rule with the issue of can we interview officers immediately at the incident? And of course, the union has fought that over and over and over again. But we push back in the political arena, as Mike said, and we were able to change that those same officers that killed Kendra James went to Appleby that later on and got their stories together, and everybody had the same story of what happened. And so we did that push, and the city council went along with us in terms of eliminating that 48 hours. So yes, the union is powerful financially, but they cannot win in the public. That's why they've lost every a major election in the city of candidates that they have chosen, because there is a shift in the public atmosphere, a shift of people becoming conscious of and aware that we have to solve this problem. And one of the things Dr. King often tells us, you know, we oppose gradualism as an urgency now, not later, an urgency right now. And we must take advantage of this movement with George Floyd movement and his death to push those structural transformations that are needed. The structure itself has to be changed. It has to be changed, you know. And in other terms, there are some things that I agree that police officers do not need to do. They do not need to handle a mental illness cases. They do not need to handle the houseless cases. That should be professional trained people that money should be shifted to them to handle those kind of cases. And there are some things that they can handle, but we have to understand that that there must be some shifting in public fund, because racism is an issue that affects housing. And we see even in the COVID-19, the health disparities where African-American, we're doing two battles at the same time. We're fighting COVID-19 and we're fighting police across the country killing us, okay? And so we're doing two battles on different fronts. And so we must in turn continue this struggle and this call. And I urge them don't distort the message with violence, but continue to push the issue nonviolently and be consistently on that issue. And the central part of that issue is accountability. I don't care how much good training you have. I don't care how much de-escalation policy you have. If you don't have accountability to enforce that, we're not going to see the transformation that's needed.
Thank you so much, Dr. Haynes. Thank you for your leadership. Let's see if we have some finishing up statements. If you could make a comment about the film as you've just watched it or seen it recently. Mike, tell us what you thought.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I sent Jason a message. I had not seen the film before. And I knew that this, you know, I was going to see it obviously before this conversation. And I was a little bit putting it off because in the context of where we are right now with George Floyd and everything that's been happening in our country, I just thought, boy, you almost need an escape instead of digging into the same, a lot of the same issues again. But, you know, as soon as I watched it, I was so thankful that I did and that I did sit through it, because it was just such a crucial reminder that this is an issue that it's not an isolated incident. This has been going on for a long time, and it affects many different people, people with mental illness and addiction and developmental disabilities, Black people. I mean, there are so many good reminders in the film. I think, you know, one of the things that stood out for me the most was just the parallels and the senselessness of the deaths and killings of both Jim and also of George Floyd. And, you know, one over what was potentially public urination, one over which is potentially, and who knows, but maybe some sort of a forgery allegation with a $20 bill. I mean, that this cannot be an acceptable response in our society to those issues. I think that we have to ask ourselves, you know, at what point do we have to just break off, you know, trying to arrest somebody for something like that and just say, hey, it's not worth the potential harming of the individual. It's not worth the potential harming of the police officer, of people in the public. And we can just say, hey, you know what? If somebody's, you know, shooting up the town, absolutely, I understand it. But, you know, if the underlying issue that we're investigating or concerned with is at such a low level, I mean, we just have to ask ourselves, is any use of force acceptable to intercede in that situation? Or do we, you know, say, hey, you know, we recognize it, we write it down, we maybe even take a picture and say, we'll address this later. It's not worth escalating these types of issues. That's a conversation that I hope we have in the coming days. And it really was something that just resonated with me after watching the movie, that this, you know, this cannot be acceptable. Use of force for these types of underlying violations cannot be acceptable. I hope that's one of the things that's one of the things I took away.
Yes, it kind of just reflect on what Mike is saying. I think the movie was very analytical with its data and its assessment, but it also drove home that James Chassie was tortured. He was tortured, and I think it drove home that point, just like the torture of George, Brother George, before he died with I Can't Breathe. There was a torturing part, an inhumanity part that took place in the officers with James Chassie as with George Floyd. You know, to beat someone to death. And then to bring him to the jailhouse, and then after that to go through a period of waiting is a torturous death. And I think we need to bring that awareness. And I think that awareness came to the screen that there's an inhumanity in some officers in their terms of treating the houseless and treating community of colors and treating the poor, you know, and treating Black men and women. And so, and I think the movie did an excellent job on that.
Very high praise, thank you.
Thank you.
Ryan, take us out. How does it feel 7 years later, having made this film? How does the world feel to you?
You know, I must naively say that, you know, when we were making the film and, you know, and at the end of the process, the Department of Justice came in, I really thought, okay, you know, the feds are coming in, everything will be okay now. And, you know, as Reverend Dr. Haynes so eloquently said, you know, it's a marathon, not a sprint, and it's not going to be a one thing happens and things change for the good permanently. We have to just keep vigilant and keep on keeping on. And, you know, just the inhumanity of what we saw with George Floyd, you know, and both, you know, Mr. Floyd and Mr. Chassie, unarmed, handcuffed men. I mean, what kind of a physical threat can that pose? And look at the results. You know, I just have to believe that if we keep, you know, speaking truth to power, that change will come. It may not be as quick as we like, but it will come. And I especially just want to thank Reverend Dr. Haynes for your decades of leadership and hard work. And thank you.
Thank you.
Well, great. Thanks, folks, for listening and watching. Be the change, and we'll see you in the streets.